being back in New York?
Well, I'm not completely absent from New York. I drop in now and then. I love New York City.
You were born in New
Hampshire. Yep. I'm a lifelong New Hampshire resident, but I was a newspaper reporter in New York a long time ago. I miss elements of the city. I wouldn't want to live in the city. I'm raising three children, and it would be a little hard to picture their living the kind of lives that they want, riding their bicycles and going here and there with a lot of freedom here.
I raised one here, and it's tough.
Uh-huh.
In private schools, ultimately boarding schools.
Uh-huh.
It's not easy. And most of the people in my building, after they got a second child, is new.
Mm-hmm.
When you raise two kids,
mm-hmm.
Manhattan Park is not the easiest thing. Unless your name happens to be on Onassis.
Uh-huh. But I come for doses, I'll give myself a good strong dose of New York City. Yeah.
What's it like?
I describe the place where I live as a sort of leave it to Beaver Town. It's what feels to me like a city, 20,000 people. But it's the kind of town where people know your face and name, and kids can come and go and go down to the Y on their bicycles and play a pickup game of baseball down the block, and that suits them pretty well.
Does Keene have a railroad track running down the middle?
It not quite the middle, up behind the back of the movie theater. It does indeed. In fact, I guess that's how they used to unload the sets. This will give you some idea of Keene. I used to have a pretty much life-size knight in armor on my front doorstep, which I found sort of symbolic that it was kind of guarding me, and it was stolen about a year and a half ago.
Sorry, a knight in armor?
A knight in armor, a big, tall knight in armor. This knight was stolen, and that actually is rather untypical of Keene. I never lock my door, and I feel my numbers listed. I feel very safe. But the knight was stolen, and I was sad to see him go, but went on with my life, And about three nights ago, I was sound asleep about midnight. I get a telephone call. This is the Keene police. There's a policeman knocking at your door. Would you let him in, please? So I stumble down the stairs in my pajamas, and he says, I'm Officer Riddle of the Keene police. I believe we found your knight in armor. Would you like to come with me? And, the next day, in the light of day, I wondered why I had to go that night. But at the time, I didn't question it because I'd been sound asleep. So I climb into the squad car. We drive about three blocks over to this office building that was pitch black, except there was one light shining in a window. And the officer radios into headquarters, I believe we've arrived at the scene, shines a beam of light up at this window and hands me a pair of binoculars. And through the binoculars, I can see the silhouette of a knight in armor that looks a whole lot like mine. I can't imagine spotting this just driving along in the cruiser as he was. But anyway, we pulled over, radioed into Keene Police Headquarters that we had arrived, went, knocked at the door. Actually, the door was locked, but as luck would have it, a jogger was coming down the street at this moment and led us into the apartment building, and we climbed the steps. By now, it's like 12:30 night, Knock at the door, and this guy comes to the door. There's the police officer and me in my pajamas still. I'd just thrown a coat on over my pajamas, and the officer says, we've come to report, to investigate a possible stolen knight. Would you let us in, please? And we're led into the apartment, and the guy's standing there. His girlfriend's sort of looking scared to death, and the guy brings me over to the knight, and the police officer said, would you inspect this knight? Does this look like your knight, Ms. Maynard? And I say, well, yeah, it does. To the guy, where'd you get this knight? The guy says, at a yard sale, which is exactly where I got my knight, actually. So we looked at the knight, and the guy said, but I've had him 5 years. I've got witnesses. My folks will tell you. So we looked at the knight and concluded this guy was telling the truth and said good night, and I went back to bed. So that's a very long way around of telling you what Keene, New Hampshire is like. The police remember your stolen knights. They may still get stolen, but they won't be forgotten. Yeah, still looking for him.
Well, isn't that the kind of story you used to tell in some of your columns?
It is. It is. And I don't put that in the past tense either. I still write about my life. And this novel is a real departure, but it was kind of a happy break for me. I've been chronicling my own adventures for about 20 years now, so it was nice to write the story of somebody not remotely like me, somebody life in the middle of the night consists of more than knocking on doors looking for stolen knights in armor.
Well, I understand that you got the idea of the real version.
Yes, they're
and smart.
wasn't it? Well, the novel, you know, is certainly fiction, I say swiftly, but the I make no bones about the fact that the situation was inspired by a highly sensational murder case that took place in the state of New Hampshire, in which a 23-year-old high school media teacher named Pamela Smart, a sort of hopeful TV anchorwoman type, pretty successful, accomplished, the kind of person that seemed to have everything going for her, found herself in a marriage that no longer suited her purposes, evidently, and arranged for her 15-year-old lover to have her husband murdered. And I read about that case and was very intrigued by it. And I think, having been a newspaper reporter myself, I recognized the limitations of that genre. I knew that there were a lot of questions that I had about what went on between Pam Smart and this 15-year-old boy that would never be told in any interview. And so I made up my own story, very loosely inspired by that case. But I actually took pains not to research the real case, because I sometimes feel that you find out more in fiction than from nonfiction reporting.
Well, it is indeed the case with fiction. Nonfiction can tell you the facts, but fiction can often tell you the truth.
Again,
the hearts and the minds of people that you otherwise can't really do. You can observe what they do.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's it.
You see their actions, but you don't always know the motivation.
And specifically because this was a crime that was motivated, in the case of the boy, motivated by sex, what made this happen took place behind closed doors, and nobody was there but the two principals, you know. And so I felt that my only way of seeing behind those doors was to recreate the scenes myself.
Well,
on the page.
Susie, right?
Yeah. Suzanne Moretto is our killer.
Book, but I often forget the names of the characters. But you made her a really unappetizing.
You didn't like her? You don't want her to come home for dinner? She's pretty much a portrait of evil. Yeah, I think so. Suzanne is she's the kind of a woman. I think she holds some fascination for me because I was never anything like her. She was the most popular girl in high school, you know, the cheerleader and the prom queen, who was very used to life going her way, getting what she wanted. Very pretty, very smart, and always successful. And her ambition has always been to be a celebrity, to be a television talk show hostess. And she has really groomed herself for that role from early childhood. She's a girl who, the novel is told in the reminiscences and the observations of a lot of onlookers in the scene, and her early tap dancing teacher describes how Suzanne used to stand in front of the mirror for hours practicing taking bows and blowing kisses to a non-existent audience. That's Suzanne Moretto. She's the kind of a person that smiles only as long as the camera is pointing her way, and the minute her picture is taken, her face glazes over. And she's somebody who sort of talks in sound bites and the kind of neat phrases that'll fit in a space between two commercials. But she's a woman of surface, obsession with how things look, with something crucial missing, namely heart, you know, moral core. So when she decides that it's no longer in her best interest to stay married to this kind of nice guy, nice ordinary guy, Larry Moretto, who she had married, rather than going through divorce, she decides that the swiftest and least untidy way of disposing of him is to have him murdered.
Now, you tell the story in a rather unusual way. You have quite a few different perspectives. How many people do you have?
I have never counted them up, but probably there are about 50 different voices in the novel. There are a few that come back again and again, Suzanne Moretto being one, Jimmy Emmett, the 15-year-old boy, a virgin until he is seduced by Suzanne, and being another key player. And they each tell their story in their own voice. I think I chose that medium because we learn about the characters not only from what they say, but how they say it. Suzanne really talks in cliches and sort of the kinds of aphorisms that you'd expect to find in a Chinese fortune cookie, you know. Jimmy Emmett is a boy who was passionately, obsessively devoted to this woman to the point where he would do anything for her. For him, sex was like a drug. And once he was drawn into her web, he becomes her slave. She's not the kind of person who would commit a murder herself. She keeps her hands clean. So she dispatches Jimmy and a friend of his to her condominium on a night when she knows she won't be home and her husband will be coming home late, and arranges for what is to look like a burglary. But Jimmy and Russell, this other boy, shoot her husband. Well, now, why do you say that? She comes very close to getting away with this.
Well, for one, she alienated the very person she needed to keep her mouth shut.
Yes.
And I suppose in going to the shopping center with the girl, what's her name also?
Lydia Mertz.
Lydia, who's wired.
Wired for sound.
That might be understandable, but...
Well, you know, Suzanne is an interesting character, as the real Pam Smart was, that she has, there are two diametrically opposed Suzannes. On the one hand, there is this very almost prim-looking, pretty, blonde, small-time, local TV weather girl, the good girl, the girl who always did well and got a 4.0 average in school. And then there's the bad girl, the one who sort of, who gets a tattoo, who is fascinated by heavy metal music and motorcycles. That was true with Pam Smart as well. And there is a part of her that is thrilled by her badness and almost needs to confess to it. She does talk way too much about what she has done, as Pam Smart did. And, of course, that was really what did Pamela Smart in, that she there was actually no physical evidence in the Smart murder that would have incriminated either the boys who committed the crime or Pam Smart, but after
the... Until the very end, she denies...
That's right. But what really convicted Smart was her own words on tape as she talked about the crime to her 16-year-old protege, a young girl. And there is a girl in some ways like that one in this novel, Lydia Mertz, who worships Suzanne Moretto and who eventually betrays her.
Of course, there's a major twist to the novel, which we won't give away, of course.
Thank you.
The Pam Smart story, but I guess the clue is Suzanne Moretto is an Italian family.
Well, I'm the last one who'd ever want to promote any kinds of ethnic stereotypes. Many of my dearest friends are Italian, so that could just mean that she eats a lot of pasta and puts on some weight. We won't say what happens to her.
How did you keep track of all of these books? Did you write as you went?
Well, you know, I always really wanted to be an actress, and I really performed these characters at my typewriter. Writing it down was almost after the fact. I almost felt myself channeling the voices of characters as unlike each other as a, you know, sort of burnt out local cable TV station boss of Suzanne Moretto and a 15-year-old boy who's sort of driven by his loins and the grieving parents of the murdered Larry Moretto, and a lot of kind of sometimes funny, amusing side characters. Phil Donahue puts in an appearance in this book. The tap dancing teacher of Suzanne, the mother of the boy, Jimmy Emmett, who eventually is sent to prison for the rest of his life, who reflects in prison that he killed for sex and had sex a total of 14 times. We'll never have it again.
Did you emote after your typewriter? Dickens used to.
Do you want to emote?
Look at him, pat himself in the mirror and say, oh, I'm an humble man, all I am. Used to take the word.
I don't know. I really don't know what I do at the typewriter. I do tend to get lost in my story. My way is always, I have three children. And a lot of my life is spent being their mom. A lot of my writing life has been consumed with writing about parenthood and children, marriage, family, concerns very different from the ones in this book. And I think I chiefly write about those things because that's what the majority of my days are spent thinking about and doing. This book was written outside of that, of my normal everyday life, during a period of just a few weeks when my children were away with their father. And I think it's no accident that I wrote it then. It's such a grim, dark, ugly situation and such a sort of scary set of characters that I don't think I would have wanted to immerse myself in those voices and those lives while my children were around. I don't mean that I would have committed crimes, but I really these are not wholesome people. I have to admit, and I wrote in a very intense period of a matter of a few weeks when I really did just lose myself in this story.
Was that a few weeks?
I wrote the first draft of the novel in just a couple of weeks. Yeah. Working really round the clock. I only took breaks to watch various television talk shows that kind of...
So you built up an enormous momentum.
I do, yeah. I write fast. Then I read it. I wrote this novel to entertain myself. I had been for years writing, my chief work has been for a lot of years, writing a syndicated newspaper column about my life. That has, dealing with the constant self-scrutiny that I was having to go through in the writing of that column, it was a great relief for me to write about somebody else's life for a change. No question, an escape. I had been going through some difficult times in my own life. I was going through a divorce. My mother had recently died of cancer, and I'd been taking care of her. And I really wanted to, I wrote the novel that I wanted to read. That's the truth of it. I wanted to write the most entertaining story that I could imagine, a novel with sex and violence and mystery and suspense. And I wrote it fast, I think, because I wanted to see how it would turn out. I really didn't know when I started what was going to happen. And I wrote to find out, and then I read it in one sitting.
What about the revision process, or were you satisfied with it?
Oh, no, the novel has, you know, went through substantial revision. I'm not so... Yes, I did. I showed the novel to a number of good friends, and not all literary people either. One of the most important readers of the book for me was a 16-year-old boy who lives in my neighborhood, and I wanted him to see whether he believed those boys, those characters.
This Crest to Die For is not your first novel. Your first was
Baby Love. That's right.
A little bit about how that book came about.
A similar situation. I wrote my novel Baby Love was written over about 10 years ago now. I was living at the time in a small New Hampshire town, even smaller than Keene, where I live now, and had just one child then. My then 18-month-old daughter. And in this town, there were many teenage mothers. I was myself 23, 24 when my daughter was born. And at that age, motherhood still felt very overwhelming and very scary a lot of the time. And I would see these 15, 16-year-old girls sitting on the steps of the laundromat in my town, you know, and I would find myself wondering about what their lives were like. And that really was the inspiration for the first novel. I sat down with the typewriter, not having a clue, no plan, no outline. I just knew that I wanted to know about those girls' lives. And I think the first sentence of that novel is, three girls sit on the steps of the laundromat. I figured that if I first described a scene and described characters, that at some point they would take on lives of their own and they would make things happen. That is my belief about the kind of fiction that I write, that I begin with characters. I begin by creating a person, and then that person begins to move and to do things and to relate to other people, other characters, and stuff happens. I'm Geppetto, you know.
Well, if you're in fiction and your comics and so forth, you're a long way from the raw life of everyday journalism. How do you feel about it? You started very precocious. I think you started in your early 20s.
I began publishing my work when I was in my early teens.
In terms of actual daily journalism.
I became a newspaper reporter when I was about 20 in New York City, but I had already by that time been doing magazine journalism for quite a few years, it's true. I was working as a reporter for the New York Times when I met the man who became my husband and knew I wanted to start a family, and we moved back to New Hampshire, and I think I had very unrealistic notions about what parenthood involved. I really did suppose that I'd have this baby and carry on life as usual, just, you know, periodically changing her diapers and bouncing her on my knee and singing songs and reading books to her. I didn't understand the degree to which having a child would transform every moment of my life. And it was only after my daughter Audrey was born, she's almost 14 now, that I saw that my days of jumping on planes, covering stories, and interviewing, you know, Muhammad Ali in his training camp or some murderer in prison were over. But I still had to earn a living, very much so, to pay for all those diapers, you know. So I really created a beat for myself, which was my own life. I started writing about babies and children because that's who I saw. I was living in a pretty isolated little farmhouse at the end of a long, dead-end dirt road in a small New Hampshire town, and who I spent my days with were children.
You kind of like a latter-day Shirley Jackson. You ever look
like... that's fine company. I mean, she was an extraordinary writer.
Bennington,
Vermont, right. It's always been my belief that ordinary life contained the greatest drama. You know, when I was a newspaper reporter, I did a fair amount of celebrity interviewing, and I had been a small town girl. I was as impressed as the next person, probably more so than many, by meeting these famous people. You know, people I'd seen in the movies or people whose records I listened to. But I lost my taste for that, with a few exceptions, pretty swiftly, because although many of those people, no doubt, were fascinating, extraordinary people. I really came to feel that the most interesting voices were ordinary voices. The greatest dramas that I was likely to experience were in the lives of regular people going about their business, you know, shopping at the supermarket. I suppose maybe, you know, I started doing it so young that no, I think not for very long.
At first, but after a while, you just have to do the work.
Yeah, yeah. And
if you allow yourself, if you've not been attentive, I mean, I in the last 15 years or so, I've focused on office, and there have been people like Orbital and people like that who have...
Really?
But now, I know that I have to ask questions, I have to get an interview done on tape,
mm-hmm.
It has to be edited, the piece has to be written, it has to be voiced, carded, and labeled, and I have all of these mechanical things, and so, you know, as I do an interview,
you're not scared of me?
I'm thinking ahead, how much work will
sure.
I do, and will I get a sound bite?
Uh-huh.
I hate to use the term sound bite, it sounds so unjournalistic.
Uh-huh. Well, I've kind of written a novel about sound bites.
But I'm sure that is what probably happened to you as you began doing more and more interviews, you began to deal with the mechanics of it.
You know, if you try to take three children ages 6 and under to New York City with $25 in your pocket, and one of them falls in the pond in Central Park and the other one gets lost on the subway, there aren't too many things after that seem scary. And it's been a long time since I've been nervous, I've got to say. It has. My life sort of provided me with the biggest challenges, and I don't think there's anybody that I could face across the table in an interview situation who would scare me as much as a 2-year-old lying down in the middle of the aisle of the supermarket, not budging an inch.
Well, now leaving the daily journalism of the raw kind of did show she missed the Persian Gulf War. Wouldn't you have liked to have been there?
That's not the story that if I were choosing stories, and I guess this is going to invite the question what one I would choose. That's not the one. Partly because, you know, it kind of gets back to what I was saying about the Smart case. I think there were fascinating stories to be told in that war, but I don't think the press got much access to them. That was such a managed war, and the press was so confined and restricted that the best stories, in many cases, I suspect, you know, remained untold.
You're probably right. I mean, it also happened very fast, but it was interesting. It was the first war you saw live.
Yes, yeah.
It was incredible. I watched it. I worked on it a lot here, but I didn't go over there. But I worked on that story because we suspended all of it, programming except that, for weeks. And it was hypnotic. We would have, well, we're in radio, we still kept CNN on.
Yes.
And just to watch.
I think we all did.
It was incredible.
I've always been fascinated by the role of television in our lives. I think that's been, if there's any theme to my writing, I really am. I was raised on television much more than books, to my parents' horror. Probably not, no. I've never been a very literary type, is the truth, and I'm not proud of it, but I've got to be honest. My experience of growing up is completely shaped by television images. You know, I think all of us, when we go see that movie JFK and we see that film footage of the assassination, anybody who was alive and conscious in 1963 has a very powerful sort of gut feeling, you know where you were and so forth. I combine those sort of national images of, you know, the calm and universal experience, the Kennedy assassination, the Challenger explosion, the King assassination, with personal memories of television programs that I watched, in my case, the family situation comedies of the 50s and 60s, Leave It to Beaver, Donna Reed Show, Father Knows Best. That really was my vision of normal life. I shaped my vision of who I wanted to be from television. I think my character, Suzanne Moretto, has done the same thing. She has a different set of images. It's not Donna Reed she wants to be. It's Barbara Walters or Deborah Norville. But she's still operating in a way that's very familiar to me, of sort of picking up her sense of the way the world works from television. I see it in my children. You know that you were talking about the Gulf War. My sons, who knew of war chiefly from G.I. Joes, watched these, you know, these fireworks-like explosions on the screen, and it was so unreal to them. It was, you know, it was like a Nintendo game.
It was unreal to everyone.
And I think that partly what this novel is about is the effect that television has had on all of our lives. It doesn't simply report what has happened, but it shapes what happens.
In effect, what you're saying is Suzanne, developed a fantasy image of television. She wanted to put herself in this fantasy.
Well, yes, and that she talks as if she's on television, whether she's on television or not. I think that in a different way, Jimmy, the young boy, is seduced by Suzanne as much as we might be seduced by a shampoo commercial, you know. She has created a product that she has packaged and marketed very successfully and sold. And it bears a higher price than shampoo.
Joyce, you said that you don't consider yourself literary, but I seem to have read somewhere in the press to hear that you had a long-time friendship with Katie Salinger. You certainly must have had some literary pretensions to strike up that kind of friendship.
Well, you know, I have many friends who write and read and care about books, and I won't go so far as to say I don't care about books. I mean only that I'm not a particularly well-read person. I'm a college dropout, for starters. And I guess my literature has always been much more rock and roll music, television, popular culture. I guess I'm fascinated by American popular culture.
Didn't you and Salinger talk about books?
Forgive me, because my own life is pretty much of an open book, but I really don't talk about him because neither does he, right. It was a long time ago, and he's made his views known about his desire for privacy, and nobody who respected him would want to violate them.
Well, I always said that I was never going to go to Elaine unless Woody Allen invited me. I don't think Woody is ever going to invite me. But I would go to Elaine's, and I would invite J.D. Salinger, if he wants to come. This is an open invitation.
Something tells me you're not the first one who's tried.
Well, tell me about what's next in terms of what's on the literary horizon for you in the future.
Well, I have been at work for some time, longer than I began this project before the novel, with a book about the death of my mother. And I guess it's really about mothers and daughters. My mother, who was a powerful figure, a really larger-than-life kind of a mom, was diagnosed with an inoperable brain tumor 2.5 years ago. It'll be 3 years ago this Mother's Day. And I dropped everything in my life at that point. Probably nothing short of such a diagnosis would have caused me to do this, and went to care for her during the last 3 months of her life. And that was a period I would mark it as the most crucial months of my life ever, so far. My life's not over. I was 35 years old at the time. I'd been married 11 years. I had 3 children. And I thought I knew probably what I was going to be doing for the rest of my days, namely staying in a difficult, and I'll even go so far as to say painful, marriage, out of a sense of responsibility to be a good mother, you know that phrase, and to provide a kind of secure, stable home, my version of Father Knows Best and Leave It to Beaver for my kids. And that interlude that I spent outside of my life, looking at my life in ways that I had not done. You know, when you're in the thick of things, caring for 3 kids and driving the carpool, you don't spend a lot of time thinking about it. But suddenly I had dropped everything, left home. I spent my days sitting in the garden holding my mother's hand and baking her pies and taking her for long, long walks. Very quiet, slow, moving, silent days. You know, you watch a person die, not a lot happens sometimes. But it was for me a time of enormous reflection, and I have to say a really rich time for both my mother and me. At the end of the summer, I left my mother's bedside. She was by that time very near the end of her days, and went back home to my husband and children. But I think I knew at that point that my marriage was over. And the book that I'm in the process of writing now is about that sort of crossroads moment in my life.
Kind of a dual sense of loss here.
It really was, and yet I also feel that it was. It's very sad to me that such good things only came from such bad things. But I also, it was really a moment of self-discovery too for me, that I think only when I lost my mother did I really find myself, and that's partly what I mean to write about. So it's not just a melancholy book at all. I was writing a newspaper column, as I think I mentioned, during this period, a weekly syndicated column, and the column had been sort of funny stories about the kids, you know, comical exploits and so forth, and serious things too. But the column was about my life, and while my life was caring for my mom, there was really nothing for it but to write about that. The column changed very dramatically. I really wrote about my mother's this period for 15 weeks, over the course of which I received well over 1,000 letters from readers that really, who were writing about their relationships with their mothers, living and dead. And I came to feel that, you know, for all of us, whatever age we are, however many children we may have ourselves, we are the daughter as well as being the mother. And whether you have resolved your relationship with your mother or not will color the rest of your days. I will be grateful forever that I got to finish things up in the way that I did with my mother. And, of course, not everybody is so lucky.
You said you had many letters. I think I read someplace in the press that you had a newsletter.
I'm actually just starting this. I ended the newspaper column last June, after 8 years. 8 years, week in, week out, you know, never a break. And it was really time. I felt it was time to give my children some privacy, myself some privacy. But I had such a close connection with my readers that many of them continue to write to me. Many of them have become friends, actually, and many spoke of missing the column, and they themselves write such wonderful letters that I felt there was a need to not only to stay in contact with them, but for them to sort of hear each other's voices. So I am actually just now in the process of establishing. I finally got input into my computer all the addresses of the, there are about 2,000 of them, the people that have written to me in the last year, and I'm starting slowly to put them in touch with each other and create a kind of what I think is a mouthpiece for a set of voices, not just women's voices, but many of them women's, about their lives. I guess it goes back to this old theme of mine of regular people's lives, ordinary people's lives being extraordinary.
When you put in the addresses of people,
it's more complicated than that, and I'm just really starting it up. But no, for the first newsletter, which I'm putting together now, is my own letter to these readers. I always thought of the newspaper column as a letter to friends. I wrote in a very personal way about myself in the newspaper. And people responded by writing back very personally to me. Many of them told me things that I believe they had told nobody else ever. And sometimes the letters were so important to answer that I would just pick up the phone. In fact, that usually was what I would do when I got a really a letter that just demanded response. And so over the years, I have maintained relationships with hundreds of women and some men, but especially women readers all over the country. And that's been an ongoing relationship. But it was so demanding of my time and almost more than that, emotional energy, that I sadly came to the point of feeling I just couldn't keep in touch with so many people, keep all of them in my heart all the time. It left me no space for my own life, and it was out of that that I came up with this notion of the newsletter that I would write to people. And I'm a small town person, and I have a sort of trusting attitude. I'm running it on the honor system. I'm asking people who can afford to contribute to the postage to do so, and if they can afford to contribute enough to the postage to pay for some who can't, then that's fine too. But yeah, I'm sending out the first issue on my own hook, and we'll see what happens after that. I have a special one of my subcategories is men. one of my fantasies has always been I travel around and speak, especially in cities where the column ran. And I've always wanted to just go to one of those cities and give a party. I myself, I'm a good cook, and I love to have friends for dinner. And I have wanted to go to these cities and just have a potluck dinner. So that's actually one of the thoughts that I have about this newsletter, that I'll sometimes... There are pockets of readers in the various places where the column ran, Oregon being one, Minnesota being another. And I want these people to see and hear from each other in ways that always happen when I go speak somewhere, that I'll give a talk, but long after I've stopped speaking, I look at the women in the room finding each other. I remember once speaking, I think it was in Oregon, a woman came up to me and she told me that she gives a slumber party every year for a group of adult women friends. I loved that idea. I think there are not enough opportunities for women, especially women raising young children, to get together and hear from each other. And that's partly what the newsletter, the function of the newsletter.
It sounds like you're always thinking, always have something to think.
I think most of us are always thinking. I can't say that I'm sure about Dan Quayle, but...
the next thing you'll think about is trying to get a job on a cable station during the weather.
I'm not remotely tempted. I think I'd have to spend much too much time in front of the mirror. I don't... No.
Well, to die for, that's a polished book, and it makes you think, and it's a scary book.
It may not be highbrow, but I think you won't put it down. I can say that much.